This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's one thing to sign these into law. It's another thing to ensure that this does not kill the infant industry in the country.
And that's Chijioke Nelson, who started Nigerian footwear company Chinelk Outfits on concerns about the new African Continental Free Trade Agreement. Also, Sudan has restored internet services after more than a month. UN experts say violence has dropped in the Democratic Republic of Congo's Kasai region. And Kenya has launched an ambitious program to save the mountain Bongo from extinction. We'll have these stories and more for you, so do stay with us. There's lots more ahead here on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, a recently signed African Continental Free Trade Agreement is intended to increase trading among African nations and eliminate tariffs and bottlenecks. But some manufacturers in Nigeria say that wading into the continental market could undermine local players and have negative implications. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
When Chijioke Nelson graduated at the top of his class at the University of Nigeria, Nsukka, in 2015, he had no intention of getting a regular job. Nelson started footwear company Chinelk Outfits almost immediately after graduation. The business management graduate says he wants to contribute to Nigeria's economic growth. Nelson, however, says he is concerned that President Muhammadu Buhari's recent signing of the Africa trade deal in Niger might put small manufacturers like him out of business.
It's one thing to sign these into law. It's another thing to ensure that this free trade, whatever that has been signed into law, does not kill the infant industry in the country, because this has to do with cross transportation of items and produced or manufactured goods.
Nigeria initially walked out on the deal and spent months deliberating on the risks involved in exposing local manufacturers to increased competition in the continental market. After reviewing an impact assessment in June, the president agreed to sign the deal, says Razak Okulaja, a council member with the Manufacturers Association of Nigeria, or MAN.
The concern that, as manufacturers, we had is, are we ready? So MAN requested for some time, have good meetings with stakeholders, let's look at it again, and kudos to the government. Government listened.
While skepticism runs high, some local manufacturers like Jibril Mohammed say they are looking forward to expanding their business through the trade deal.
I'm very, very interested because I think I'll get one of the countries around and even how often my office, even if it's a showroom, for me to move my product direct.
Inter-regional trade in Africa only accounts for 17% of the continent's total exports, compared to 69% in Europe and 59% in Asia, respectively. The trade deal could drive the numbers up to 52.3%. Ken Ife is a lead economic consultant at ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States. He says Nigeria's decision to participate in the deal is a boost to the pact.
Nigeria is the big boy, that is the big event that is there waiting to happen. And that's why they are very patient with Nigeria. Not only that, we are instrumental in the various phases in the development or evolution of this. We actually want to be the capital of the AFCTA, and justifiably so, because it looks like it's zoned to ECOWAS sub-region, and we are the number one in the Africa anyway, both in terms of population and in terms of size of economy.
The African trade deal gained momentum in May after it was ratified by the parliaments of 24 African countries. The continent's manufacturing industry accounts for only about 10% of the African Union's combined GDP of $3.4 trillion. In Nigeria, manufacturers face diverse production challenges that put them at a disadvantage when compared to their counterparts on the deal. But many here are waiting and watching to see the steel turn around their businesses and the economy. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Eight years after South Sudan's independence, hunger continues to plague the world's youngest nation. A recent United Nations report shows nearly half of the population, 6.1 million people, are facing some degree of food insecurity. Sheila Pony looks at the challenges from the Upper Nile region of South Sudan.
Thompson Piri is the World Food Programme's communication manager in South Sudan.
South Sudan is one of the most complex operations for the World Food Programme globally. This is mainly because 60% of the areas are inaccessible by road during the rainy season. And ironically, the rainy season coincides with the peak hunger season in South Sudan when people struggle to put food on their table.
Hungry people mean business is urgent at a food distribution center in the UNPOC in Malakal, South Sudan, as WFP staff distribute monthly food rations to some of the internally displaced people who live here. Mary La and her 12 children have lived in this camp with 30,000 other internally displaced persons for 6 years. Before the 2013 war, she said, things were good. That she and her husband used to farm and fish and make their own food. But now, she says, they are depending on humanitarian aid and struggle to make the food allotment last each month. Others in this crowded tent city say they would like to return home but have never tried because their homes no longer exist. Some worry about what might happen beyond the security provided by the walls of POC in Malakal. Elijah Nyolol is the director of relief and rehabilitation in Central Upper Nile State.
They want to see the information of the government, the central government. That one will give them the confidence that now we think that peace is in place.
Last year's fragile peace deal has allowed the WFP to pre-position 173,000 tons of food, 66,000 tons more than last year in 60 locations ahead of this rainy season. That will help more than 5 million people. But the country's Minister of Agriculture and Food Security said the ultimate goal is self-sufficient.
The problem is not somebody coming to give us food to become independent. The problem is how we can produce food, our own food, to become independent.
However, Hazel DeWet, the UNMISS field coordinator for the Upper Nile region, says from government to humanitarian organizations to citizens living in the POCs, there is agreement on what is most important.
If we don't have peace, yes, as indicated, people won't be able to go back, plant, harvest, and return to their normal life.
Something echoed in the POC sides.
There is no alternative unless we accept peace.
Sheila Pony for VOA News, Malakal, South Sudan.
Sudanese authorities have restored internet services more than a month after they were cut off when the military violently broke up protests calling for civilian rule, leaving dozens dead. The Transitional Military Council cited security reasons for the internet break. The 3G and 4G data connections were restored today after a court ruled yesterday in favor of a lawsuit challenging that cutoff. The loosening of media controls comes as the military and protesters are set to sign an agreement on a power-sharing transitional government, raising cautious optimism for a peaceful solution to the standoff. Moving to the Democratic Republic of Congo now, and a team of UN experts reports a decrease in violence in the country's Kasai region and say a change in governing authorities may present an opening for peace and reconciliation in the troubled region. The team presented a report today on the current situation in Kasai to the Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for us from the council in Geneva.
The chairman of the team of experts, Senegalese lawyer Bakary Ndiaye, says Kasaï remains riven with violence and gross violations of human rights. But he says newly elected Congolese authorities are committed to punishing serious crimes. And this, he says, gives hope that conditions are in place to begin the fight against impunity and to consider community reconciliation. However, he says, the relative calm that has settled over the region in recent months is precarious as humanitarian crises continue to erupt. He speaks through an interpreter.
We have seen from the demobilization and the clashes in February 2019 between the regular army and the Kamuina Nsapu militia, a number of problems. The context, however, is propitious for peace and for all the players concerned to play their role.
Ndiaye says reconciliation will be possible only if victims of crimes receive justice. He urges the authorities to strengthen the fight against impunity. He says investigations into violence committed in Kasaï between 2016 and 2017 have not resulted in a single verdict. Speaking through an interpreter, he calls for an acceleration of investigations into all serious crimes.
The investigation strategy and prosecution strategy adopted by military justice should better reflect the massive number of sexual and gender-based violence, as well as the situation of child soldiers. Decapitation crimes, the destruction of buildings, burning of homes and persecutions should also be covered.
Ndiaye warns the window of opportunity for peace risks closing if Kasaï, a poor landlocked region, does not receive support in improving its economic and social development. DRC's Minister of Human Rights, Marie-Ange Mushubekwa, agrees major steps toward reconciliation and a lasting settlement of the conflict in Kasaï are taking place. She urges the UN Council to extend the mandate of Bakary Ndiaye's team for another 12 months. She says that extension is needed to support the Congolese government in implementing its recommendations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, to North Africa now, as mass protests calling for the political reforms in the country continue, Algerian interim president Abdelkader Ben Salah says Algeria needs a national dialogue to lay the groundwork for presidential elections to end a political crisis. Algerian demonstrators, especially the youth, are seeking the departure of senior figures, including politicians and businessmen who have governed the North African country since independence from France in 1962. The youth are pushing for radical change. William Lawrence is a professor of political science at George Washington University. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shenawy about what is needed for this kind of dialogue to succeed.
The most important thing is that the military play a minimal role and that officials associated with the Bouteflika regime not included. That doesn't mean down the road that we shouldn't have some sort of reintegration of former regime officials. We had that mistake in Tunisia in a different way in Libya where there was total exclusion. But certainly during this transitional period, we need all of this civil society organizations and all the political parties to have their own conversation about how to proceed. Among the issues, there's a constitutional basis for election. Most of the protesters reject the current constitution. There are bad voter rolls and voting rules that need to be amended. And so all of these would have to be worked out during the national dialogue, for which the primary goal, according to all the Algerian groups, is to hold elections.
But Algerian demonstrators, especially youth, are seeking the departure of all senior figures, especially the politicians who have governed the North African country since the independence of France in 62 and are pushing for radical change. Do they have a practical vision for the future of Algeria?
Not yet, but they are working on it. There seems to be increasing consensus among the various civil society groups, protesters, and political parties on what the future of Algeria might look like. They certainly agree on a bunch of what I might call negative goals. So they don't want corruption and they do want this purging to go on. But in terms of, for example, what political system they would have, there isn't strong consensus yet. There are more consensus about who needs to leave and what needs to end than there is about what needs to replace it. But we have had, for example, the meetings last Saturday where there was some progress. And I think going forward, part of the problem will be the same one that Tunisia had and a number of other regimes in transition have, is how many people do you push out? And that's why in one of the more recent speeches, the head of the transition said we'd have to have some rule to protect, for example, government civil servants so that they wouldn't be entirely purged. But right now, the situation is a lot better than it's been in recent weeks because it seems that the military is signaling that it might be willing to go back to the barracks a little bit and let this process continue in a way that doesn't involve impression, a repression, and lets the civil society organizations and the political parties take the lead.
But Armed Forces Chief Lieutenant General Ahmed Qaid Saleh, who has been managing the transition so far, has called on political parties to meet among themselves to discuss a way out of the crisis. Is there a consensus among these parties on a roadmap?
There is a growing consensus, but for example, that they would have elections in 6 months, and I don't think they can do this given the problem with the voting rolls and the problem with how elections have been organized in recent years in Algeria. I think it would probably take longer than that. And I also believe that they need a better constitutional basis. And so whether they have an amended constitution or some sort of constitutional declaration or something like this, as we saw in some other neighboring countries in transition, there needs to be a more realistic timetable. I think rushing to elections could be destabilizing, as we have seen in the past in Algeria. And the most important thing is that we have a transitional authority that's civilian-led and is keeping the security forces in their barracks, but then doesn't seed some sort of chaos in the streets. So far, so good. Algerian protesters continue to be peaceful, and the military seems to have learned the lesson of recent weeks that the best place for security forces is back in the barracks and not in the streets.
And that was William Lawrence, Professor of Political Science at George Washington University, speaking there with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi. France has confirmed reports that some of its US-made missiles were found at a base used by the self-styled Libyan National Army, but says they were damaged and were being stored pending demolition. France denies it had broken an arms embargo and supplied the missiles to forces loyal to strongman Khalifa Haftar. But the admission raised questions about how Haftar's fighters obtained the weapons. A French military statement today said the Javelin anti-tank missiles were originally intended to protect French anti-terrorism forces in Libya. Confirming a report in the New York Times, the statement said France had purchased the missiles that were discovered in a camp south of Tripoli in June. A UN-backed government in Tripoli has accused foreign powers of helping Haftar in his push to take control of Tripoli. The fighting has killed at least 1,000 people and forced tens of thousands to flee their homes. Moving to East Africa now, and Kenya has launched an ambitious recovery program to restore the population of the critically endangered mountain bongo, which is at risk of extinction. With fewer than 100 left in the wild forest, the mountain bongo is classified as a critically endangered species. From Nanyuki, Kenya, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
Kenyan wildlife officials say not much attention has been given to the plight of the magnificent antelope subspecies as compared to rhinos, elephants or lions. Najib Balala is Kenya's Tourism and Wildlife Cabinet Secretary.
Today we are here launching the National Recovery and Action Plan for the mountain bongos. Currently we have 96 of them in the wild, all over the mountain areas, and 77 which are under captivation here. They are being taken care of by the Mount Kenya Conservancy, which is a great initiative.
Adult mountain bongos are primarily found in Kenya. In 2004, 18 mountain bongos bred in the United States were repatriated to Kenya in a bid to save the rare species from extinction. But the latest initiative, known as National Recovery and Action Plan, seeks to address the challenges facing the mountain bongo antelopes and will jumpstart the process of reversing their population decline. Margaret Mbaka is a trustee of Mount Kenya Wildlife Conservancy, which is at the forefront of raising awareness on the importance of protecting the iconic species that inhabit the country's forested mountains.
We have been actually almost so handedly, really, with a few of the supporters seeking donations, managing their health. And now what we have been doing with KWS and Kenya Forest Service is to request that we are given some space in the mountain so that we will be able to slowly release them to a place which we are planning to fence out, so that when they go there, slowly we'll be able to win them out and win them back to the forest. And once they are in the wild, they are wild animals, which is really what we want.
Established in 2004, the Conservancy runs a bongo breeding program where caregivers feed and train the antelopes before they can be released into the natural habitat. Balala says conserving the mountain bongo will have a positive impact on Kenya's fragile tourism sector and will improve the livelihoods of rural communities.
We need to coexist between communities and wildlife. We benefit from wildlife, from tourism, but I think we can do much more to make our people have ownership, but also feel the benefits of conservation. Conservation is not cheap, it's expensive, but we're going to do everything to do.
The four-year plan will focus on increasing security to deal with illegal poaching, as well as engaging with the local host communities to curb deforestation. Rhino Hack, a local charitable trust, is working in collaboration with the Kenya Wildlife Service and other partners to secure and protect the natural habitats by constructing perimeter fences and providing security. Christian Lambert is the executive director of Rhino Hack Charitable Trust.
I'm quite optimistic because we have the very strong backing from the Kenyan government, and there are many partners being involved. Many NGOs and private partners fully on board and ready to invest towards conserving the bongo and towards engaging forest adjacent communities in conserving that specific species. I believe it will work.
Illegal hunting, logging, disease and loss of habitat have wiped out 80% of the world mountain bongo population since 1970, with experts warning that extinction is a real possibility. But to support their recovery and survival, the new initiative aims at securing a population of 730 bongo antelopes over the next 50 years. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nanyuki, Kenya.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Haiti Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, do visit our website at voaafrica.com. And please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. That's coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Justin Thwaites, thank you for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, historically black colleges and universities in the United States have also educated prominent Africans, like the founding presidents of Nigeria, Ghana, and Malawi. The role of historically black colleges and universities on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat and dombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.